All right, so we are continuing our church history. I have to say that because it's on our we're recording now, so people have to listening on the internet have to know what we're doing. So we're starting again our church history. We're on to chapter week 12. It says there formation of the OPC. This is the one where our denomination actually gets established. So that means we're going to get up to 1936. We'll talk about that here momentarily. But this lesson really is the culmination of 3 weeks that all deal with the same big topic. Anybody remember what the big topic is that we've been talking about? Mike?
The modernist fundamentalist.
That's right, the modernist fundamentalist controversy. And I think one thing that will become interesting today, we have talked about these two sides, and there's really a third side that, unfortunately, I think has contributed a lot to this controversy. The third side is somewhere in between, what's called the moderates. And the moderates would believe what the conservatives believed in terms of the gospel and Reformed theology, but they weren't quite nearly as ardent about it and were willing to tolerate the modernists. And I think that's, unfortunately, a problem we're going to find in today's message that we're or topic that we're looking into. So we've been dealing with this controversy for 3 weeks now. This is the third week. 2 weeks ago, that was when Mike taught it. Do you remember what Mike kind of focused in on? He kind of set the stage for us. And he introduced three main people. Anybody remember the people that he mentioned? Jeff?
One was Machen.
One was Machen, that's right, which particularly has been the main person, main hero we've been talking about through these last 3 weeks, or will especially today. J. Gresham Machen, really the, in so many ways, a sort of founding father of our denomination, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And any other names remembered? We talked about Briggs the week before, and he really was the kind of transition or segue into this controversy. He was like, just a few years before all this really got started, he was the one speaking toward things like against the inerrancy of Scripture. And so he's certainly in that cast of infamous people.
We talked about William Jennings Bryan.
That's right, yeah. What do you remember about him?
He was a presidential candidate 3 times.
Okay.
He advocated the gold standard.
Okay.
And he was a Cumberland Presbyterian.
That's right. And I don't know if we mentioned all the things you just mentioned in there, but those things are all true, I believe. He was also the guy doing the Scopes monkey trial on evolution, and kind of was painted by the press as this kind of crazy fanatic almost. And I think part of what Mike was trying to do is that contrast his presentation. He was a fundamentalist versus Machen, who came across again as a fundamentalist, but came across as this very well-educated, articulate, well-spoken speaker for the fundamentalist movement. And the other person was Harry Emerson Fosdick, and he was an infamous figure. He was a modernist or theologically liberal, and he was brought into a pulpit in the Presbyterian Church in the New York Presbytery, and he wrote that infamous sermon, "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" And that was one of the key players in kind of getting some of the controversy going here. So that all being said, that was 2 weeks ago. Last week, anybody remember what we focused on last week? Jim, remember what we focused on last week? Get your No problem. Anybody? So we got into some of the chronology now, the events that actually took place, and we were focusing a lot on the 20s. And we saw that GA, up until middle of the 20s there, had made several times where they affirmed the five fundamentals of the faith, and said that ministers of the Presbyterian Church need to affirm these five fundamentals of the faith. And what were those five fundamentals again? Inerrancy of Scripture.
Miracles.
Virgin birth.
Substitutionary
atonement.
Resurrection.
That's right. Resurrection. Exactly. Good. Bodily resurrection. Not like, you know, how important today, right? I mean, there are people that want to still think of a spiritual resurrection without a bodily resurrection. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ isn't raised, we're of all men most to be pitied. Right? I mean, if he's not raised, our whole faith is a farce, right? And that's why it's so essential to us. So, okay, and so then in GA doing that, they had the Auburn Affirmationists come up. And they had the Auburn Affirmation. And what did they call those five fundamentals?
Niceties or possibilities or
theories. That's right, yeah. Theories. Those are nice theories, but don't impose those things on us. And then they had that special commission in 1925. And they did some research and essentially concluded, let's all get along and stop, you know, calling the modernists bad names. And that was not a win for conservatives. And that set then the precedence that the different church boards and church committees and commissions began more and more to get modernists put on there as a sense of official toleration for them was granted. That began to then spread more and more. And we saw particularly it happened at one institution. What was the institution last week?
Princeton,
that's right. Which caused the faculty, a lot of them, to leave and start
Westminster
and Philly. That's right. And eventually, you know, many years later, they came, and some of those guys from Westminster, Philly, helped get Westminster, California started, which is where I went to school, and it's where Mike went to school, and we're very blessed for that. So, so today, then, we kind of pick up there, and we're heading into the 1930s now, and what I just mentioned, the modernists starting to infiltrate more and more all the different boards and committees and commissions of the denomination, that's become, by this point, a big problem. And the battle now really turns to focus on missions, particularly the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions. And this is interesting. Julie had a great insight last week. I was so proud of that great insight. She said, well, I've heard so much about the church history with regard to OPC, and it always, the formation of it, always been talked about the foreign missions problem. And she hadn't realized that it was this bigger issue, and that the foreign missions is really, as we're going to see today, one board, one small segment that became kind of the, what do they say, the spark that, what do they say?
It could be a straw for the camel's back.
That's right, the straw that broke the camel's back. Yeah, maybe that's a good, or the little spark that let off when everything was all ready to go. Yeah, so that's really what we're going to see. In fact, there's a good argument to say that the Foreign Missions Board, which is where the controversy comes and the battle takes place, there's an argument to be made that they were actually less theologically liberal than many of the other boards and committees that were there. But they actually chose, as we'll see why today, to really stand their ground here and fight the good fight here. And it didn't work out very well for the conservatives. Well, depends on, I guess, our perspective. We're all here today in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church because of it. But okay, so in our first point now, we're really now onto the outline. We're up to two different mission boards. So in 1932, a book was published called Rethinking Missions. And this became a major catalyst for this fight regarding the Foreign Missions Board. And what happened was, is this was like this ecumenical effort putting together this book called Rethinking Missions. Had a lot of different influences, but some of the people involved on the Board of Foreign Missions in the Presbyterian Church of USA were also involved in this group that put out this book, Rethinking Missions. So when the book came out, the board read it and studied it and thought, how can we learn from it and use this in our mission work? Well, the problem was, Anybody read the book? I haven't read the book, but Mike, you read the book? I read the book. What I've seen of the book is it was really like rank modernist propaganda. So the book, for example, said, you know, in the past of missions, it was like one religion over another. You know, we're all out there in the mission field trying to say, take our religion, Christianity, over this other religion. And that's how we used to do missions. But now the world's changed. And people now, it's no longer which religion, it's should we have religion? And because that's their people's way of thinking, religion or no religion now, instead of us coming like we used to and say, take Christianity over Buddhism, we need to partner together to save religion. So we work together with all these other religions. Diego Jr., good to see you. We take all these different religions and we just kind of find a way to kind of stand in the religion yes category against the religion no category. And so that works well if you're a theological liberal. That works well if you're a modernist. But it doesn't work well when you believe that the claims of Christianity, particularly the ones that are rather exclusive, are actually true. And that we need to have a hearing for that and promote the biblical faith. And so this book, which is just so against what Christianity according to the Bible is, was taken by the Board of Foreign Missions. And here's a name here, Robert Speer. Robert Speer, he was the secretary of that Foreign Mission Board. And he was a moderate. And he was well-loved by the denomination. He had been serving, since the 1800s in that position. Toward the end of 1800s, he got hired on as this secretary. So he'd been serving for a long time. He was like a foundation in that position. And he read the book and gave a sort of what I called lukewarm response. He said, oh yeah, I don't agree with all the theology here, but there's so much here we can still benefit from. And to the conservatives, that seemed to be like just an appalling sort of response. Like this is a book, you need to be like, this is just wrong. We don't want to listen to this. It's kind of like, Satan has, I don't agree with Satan, but he has some good points sometimes. That doesn't make sense, right? And so that's how they thought that Robert Speer, you know, in typical sort of moderate position of kind of wanting to show tolerance and hear out the other side, that was a problem. Another problem was, not only did they have a lukewarm response to this book, but they also showed it some of their problems by keeping hired someone named Pearl S. Buck. Has anyone heard of Pearl S. Buck? Some people have heard of Pearl S. Buck. Good. Claire, what do you know about Pearl S. Buck?
She lived in China for most of her life, and she was a missionary.
That's right. Yeah. And she was actually a missionary kid. An MK, if you will, that's what they use. A missionary kid, MK. So she grew up in China. She started writing novels. She even got a Nobel Peace Prize in literature. So rather well known. The problem was, as she grew up, she eventually came out saying she doesn't believe in Christianity. But she was still in the mission field. And she was even speaking at points, like she spoke at one point on a conference. So she, as a missionary, the title was something like, do I have the title here? I don't have the title, but like, should we be doing missions in China? And she basically said no. She's like, you know, what have we done? We've come in and imposed our Western ideas on them. And, I do think there's something to be said that we want to be careful when we go in mission field, that we don't try to confuse Christianity and the gospel with Western culture and civilization. I think we need to be careful of that wherever we go, right? Because we don't want people to confuse Christianity and the Bible with our particular cultural values. But that's not what we were trying to do when we go to China, right? We're trying to preach Christ. And so she came out very much against it. So that was another problem. She's a missionary and they're not not saying anything. They're fine with her just being a missionary, evidently.
I think it's interesting the irony of Pearl Buck basically has the, even though she's a missionary, has a logical outworking all of this, and why really even do missions? Because there's nothing special other than spreading Western civilization to foreign lands. And you know, should we be doing that? And that's kind of the question she raises, where if you don't have any gospel, why do missions in the first place? I think that's the irony, is she's like the one in the middle of it that kind of comes to that conclusion.
She's completely consistent with her viewpoint. Yeah, absolutely. Good point. So, 1B, Machen and Speer engage in debate on this matter, first at Presbytery and then at a General Assembly level. This is 1933. I was looking for a picture of Robert Speer so I could put Speer's picture on one side and Machen's on the other. I couldn't find a picture of Speer, so I didn't put either. But Machen's 6 charges against the board. 1, they had not clearly denounced the Rethinking Missions book. 2, they had not released Pearl S. Buck. They kept her on the missionary payroll. 3, the board's candidate secretary, a rather influential position, he was one of the signers of the Auburn Affirmation. 4, the board's one of the board's departments had like a recommended reading list, and some of the lists included modernist books. I think a Fosdick book was on there. 5, the board commended certain social gospel proponents. In other words, people that clearly were teaching a modernist social gospel, and they, you know, had recommendations for some of these people. And then number 6, the board cooperates with modernist groups in China. This is particularly a big issue. So they're out there in the mission field, and they're like doing joint efforts with, you know, like Buddhist groups and stuff like that. You know, these other religions, and they're doing joint efforts. So, Speer's response. He said, first off, it's discriminatory to single out our board for these matters when this is a problem throughout the denomination, the modernists. I don't know how much that really comes as an argument, right? That's kind of like what my kids say, right? But he did it. And then I say, two wrongs don't make a right, you know, that kind of thing. Number 2, Speer said the board did not have the authority to sit in judgment over ministers. It's an interesting point. It's, you know, sure, they themselves aren't the ones who would bring a charge against a minister and release them from ministry. But as the people who essentially interview and hire and manage and oversee for the missions field, the people that they're on their payroll on the missions field, it seems that that they would have a vested interest. It's kind of like on a church, right? I mean, technically, if I'm preaching heresy, it's the presbytery that will have to try and judge. But you guys, if you're hearing the heresy, I hope you'll tell somebody. I hope you'll speak up and write the charge and give it to presbytery, right? I mean, it's kind of a passing the buck, no pun intended. number 3, sorry. The board did not require tolerance for its candidates. In other words, Mach and others were saying, it looks like when you're hiring your missionaries that you are actively looking for the people that are the moderates instead of the conservatives, and Speer denies that. No, we don't have any agenda in that regard. And then finally, this is a very interesting one. Speer said that the union activities, in other words, working with these other organizations, that yes, there's dangers there. But there's dangers if we remain separate too. Really? I understand, like, if that was with regard to other Christian organizations having chances to express our connection and unity, but to have union where there's no union, and to pretend we have union, what is that, right? I mean, and that's the problem, like, from the liberals, they actually thought there was union here. And that's like to Mike's point. But to the conservatives, they said, no, there isn't union with these other groups, and we need to stop working with them. So, you would think that Machen would have won this argument. But GA actually decided overwhelmingly on Speer's side. And it seemed that a lot of the decision was like, pitched as like a loyalty to Speer. You know, Speer is this icon, this founding father in some sense to a lot of these guys. He's been there so long in this position. And supposedly, as I read about this, it seems that, you know, people got the impression that it really wasn't about the doctrine, but it's about, you know, Machen and Speer personality conflicts, and here's this beloved Speer, who again, Speer wasn't the liberal. Speer was the moderate that was tolerant of the liberal. And so, give you an example, when the moderator called Speer to come forward to give his side of the story, guess what the moderator said about Speer? He said this, as he calls Speer up, "Of whom it could be said, as it was said of his master, in him was life, and the life was the light of men." Think of how biased that is, right? I mean, yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't want you to say that about me, by the way. That's a quote for Jesus. It can be said only of him. I don't want to, please. But I mean, there was these kind of things that kind of almost made it about, like, are we going to support show our loyalty to this long-term Speer? Who, again, Speer himself was theologically sound in terms of at least his, he would affirm the things like the five fundamentals and things like that. Julie.
Well, I know under the preaching over the years has always been for us who are sitting in a congregation that we are to have our allegiance to be to Christ and not to the man in the pulpit. The man in the pulpit, the pastor in the pulpit is proclaiming Christ, and that's who our focus should be on, even though you are physically here in presence. We can hear you, we can touch you, you know, we can see you. And so it's, I think, something even in when Jesus was being tempted, you know, up on the mountaintop, do you want all these riches? And then at Bible study, when we had Herod, was all the people were saying, you are God, you are gracious, and then he died.
It is scary, yeah. So, after this failing, the conservatives said, you know, we don't want to send money to a missionary board that's going to have people like Pearl S. Buck on the payroll. By the way, Pearl S. Buck, a year later, after this whole debate, she resigns herself. And the Foreign Mission Board writes a kind of a acceptance letter of her resignation and says, with regret, we receive your resignation. With regret? that the unbelieving Christian, unbeliever, you know, resigns? And interestingly, then Speer is asked a couple of years later, how could you put with regret? And he says, oh, we meant that she no longer was a believer. That was the regret we had. But you read the resignation letter, it didn't sound that way. It sounded like, oh, we're so sorry that these conflicts forced you to feel like you had to leave. You know, that's kind of how it came across. And then he somehow, 2 years later, makes it sound like it was something different. So anyways, I can't read his mind, but the words are what they are. So, October 17, 1933, the conservatives form an independent board for Presbyterian foreign missions. And so they're going to instead hire their own missionaries and send their money there instead of the denominational missions, because they didn't feel they could do that in good conscience, sending out missionaries to go preach a different gospel. And so they do this. And by the way, after this happens, they continue to keep fighting against the denominational board, keep trying to make an influence. Reverend Carl McIntyre, we'll mention his name in a moment, he wrote a 96-page pamphlet following this, against the board, against its leadership. Maybe you guys have heard of Donald Barnhouse. He did a 16-month tour of the foreign missions and came up with a report that acknowledged that, yeah, there's modernists in a number of these places here in these mission fields that we're supporting. So then, at 1934 General Assembly, this is 1D on your outline, General Assembly passed a motion that said, ministers, we're ordering you to resign from anything to do with this independent board of foreign missions. And if you don't, we're telling your presbyteries to bring you to trial. And so this results in Machen's, he gets charged, he gets tried on the presbytery level. He's convicted and found guilty, and he's suspended from ministry in 1935. The suspension was, a stay of execution. So he was allowed to continue in ministry until G.A. heard his appeal. But here's the horrible part. They ruled, essentially kept trying to make arguments on his behalf. And they ruled time and again all his arguments as out of order. And the reason why is because they wanted to say, look, you keep trying to bring doctrinal arguments in your defense. You keep trying to use the Bible to defend you. Because he was, right? He was trying to say, look, I can't support these guys, and you are making me try to support them, and here's the reason why in the Word. And they said, no, we're not going to hear that. Out of order, because they're saying this is an administrative issue, not a doctrinal issue. Because it's an administrative issue, you're not supporting the denominational committees and boards. It's just an administrative issue, and because of that, we're not going to hear arguments in your defense with regard to Scripture. If you want to give an argument in defense of the administrative issue, we'll hear that. But the whole point is, that was what was at the core of why he wasn't supporting the denominational boards. And if you don't have given the opportunity to speak terms with the Bible, then how could he make his case? Interesting, the Book of Church Order that we have as a denomination has a little clause that on all trials, the Bible will... You can never rule the use of the Bible out of order in your defense. That's not the exact wording, but it's something like that. Seems like a good rule, right? I want to read you Machen's response after he lost the case. This is a quote from Machen a little while afterward. It says, "The Special Judicial Commission of the Presbytery of New Brunswick has simply condemned me without giving me a hearing. I am condemned for failing to obey a lawful order. But when my counsel, the Reverend H. McAllister Griffiths, offered to prove that the order that I had disobeyed was not lawful but unlawful, the court refused to him a word of argument. I am condemned for making false assertions about the modernism of the official Board of Foreign Missions. But when my counsel offered to prove that those assertions were not false but true, the court would not hear a word of the evidence that we were perfectly ready to produce. It is not too much to say that a trial conducted in that fashion is nothing but a farce. The customary attempt is being made to obscure the issue by representing it as merely administrative and not doctrinal. But I think real Christian people and even the general public are being less and less deceived by such evasion." So that was some of Machen's response after he lost that case, that trial. So... questions so far?
Mary.
Yeah.
The last thing that he said, I have it in front of me, but he says, I think the public is being deceived.
Or, yeah, being less and less deceived by such evasion.
I disagree with that. The public has continued to be deceived by exactly the things that he talks about there.
Yeah, and I think that's the sad part because we'll see in a moment. Yeah, I think that was one of Machen's biggest faults. Is I think he thought that all the moderates are going to go along with him, and all the public is going to go along with him, and sadly he underestimated the blinders that Satan had been putting on people, and so I think that's maybe one of the biggest faults. In fact, it's interesting that in some sense I wonder if he would have done better instead of really going head to head with Speer. To go head-to-head with people like Buck, people who are actually the modernists themselves. And so we can certainly wonder on the strategy here. But I think it goes to Mary's point, is that I think he had this higher estimation of what the rest of everyone actually thought in terms of biblical Christianity, and sadly that proves to not be the case. So, good observation. We're on the backside now, point F. So on June 27, 1935, the Constitutional Covenant Union was organized by approximately 100 conservatives to continue the fight against modernism and to begin to prepare for a church split. If, the writing on the wall is going on here, right? Machen and others are found guilty by their presbyteries. They're going to appeal it to General Assembly. But if they lose the appeal, we can't stay if all these guys get kicked out. So we're going to have to do a church split at that point. So between then and the next General Assembly. They're putting things into place if that happens. And so GA happens in 1936. Machen's appeal is denied. Seven others as well, also at that time, all get suspended from ministry. And so then June 11, 1936, that covenant union meets. They dissolve the covenant union and at the same time form what's called the Presbyterian Church of America, PC of A. And they have 34 ministers at that first meeting, 17 really elders, 79 laymen, and Machen was elected moderator. And I'll read Machen's words there. On Thursday, June 11, 1936, the hopes of many long years were realized. We became members at last of a true Presbyterian church. We recovered at last the blessing of true Christian fellowship. What a joyous moment it was. How the long years of struggle seemed to sink into nothingness compared with the peace and joy that filled our hearts. That was Machen just shortly after that. He wrote it in the Presbyterian Guardian. So, we have now the Presbyterian Church of America. Wait a minute, I thought our denomination was called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Well, we're going to see that in a moment. But first, point I. Only about 5,000 members ended up initially in this new denomination out of a 2 million member denomination. And I think this goes to what Mary's observation was a moment ago. Even within the denomination, he had overestimated people's insight into these matters. And I think it shows that like there's a lot of people that thought, oh, we can keep reforming. We can still work from within. It's not that time yet to leave the denomination. And as, you know, that was 1936. As we're now 2016, there's been these waves coming out of the PCUSA at different points where people finally say, enough is enough. And yet there's still people that are there that are still believing in the Bible and in Christianity, and yet they think, now is not yet the time. But they're so far from, as a denomination, the actual Bible. It's just so sad. Daniel.
You know, pretty clear evidence that it's definitely way too far gone. In May, the First Presbyterian Church of San Rafael is having a Buddhist monk speak.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, the denominational seminary, there's a number of them, but the one in San Anselmo has Unitarian Universalists go there and graduate. And why would, if you're a Unitarian Universalist, why would you want to go to a Presbyterian seminary? Well, because that's actually what they teach there now. It's essentially a Unitarian Universalist sort of denomination in many ways. Sort of all roads lead, you know, on your spiritual journey. Yeah, I think that's a good example, Daniel. When they formed this new denomination, November 1936, one of the first things they did, they adopted the Westminster Standards. And they took a little bit of time to say, which edition? Remember we talked about there's a couple revisions that have been made. It was particularly the 1903 editions that most of those editions they got rid of. Those are the ones that watered down Calvinism and predestination, Reformed theology. They got rid of those editions, kept a few of the ones that weren't issues. I think one of them was calling the Pope the Antichrist that had been taken out, so I think they kept that. Essentially by doing that, it now creates a new edition because they kept some of the 1903 editions but got rid of many, and so now they've got the 1936 edition, and it's the same one that the PCA, Presbyterian Church in America, would adopt when they much later become a denomination, which we'll talk about that in our remaining sessions. And so then in 1938, Point K, the PCUSA won a lawsuit. So the main line, the head denomination, the one that kicked out Machen and these other guys, sued the new denomination, which was called the Presbyterian Church of America, and they sued them. They said the name was too similar. Our name is Presbyterian Church of the USA. This is Presbyterian Church of America. They sued them. They won. And so they had to change the name. And so they changed the name to the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. So that was in 1939. So that's how we got our name. And of course, Orthodox means right doctrine. Right? That's what that word means. So they're trying to make a comment. You could go to the unorthodox Presbyterian Church, or you could go to the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. So, as you look at the next point, then I guess you could say maybe Machen was never in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Because he actually died before that name change. Now, so I was being funny, because he was in the same denomination, right? We just changed the name. But look how close from when we started the denomination to when he dies. You know, we started it in June 1936. January the next year, their hero, Machen, dies. And I didn't write it down. I think he was in his 50s. He was pretty young. He caught pneumonia. You know, the idea is, thinks he was so working so hard in all this, so much stress, and then caught pneumonia and was still traveling around. And he died. Yeah. So, the first split, point number two, creation of the BPC. In Presbyterian world, we got acronyms for all the different groups. The BPC stands for Bible Presbyterian Church. Quickly after the formation of the new denomination, it became clear that there were kind of two groups within the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. They would all consider themselves fundamentalists, you know, affirm those five fundamentals of the faith. And yet there are three key controversies that came up. One was a doctrinal one. These Bible Presbyterian guys, the guys who will become the Bible Presbyterian Church, they were explicitly wanting to promote premillennial eschatology. So, you know, look at the book of Revelation. It talks about a thousand-year reign. And is that a metaphorical or a symbolic term? Or is it an actual term? And they wanted to say it's an actual term. Christ is going to come back before that time, establish a 1,000-year reign on earth, etc. And so that was a big distinctive to them, and they really wanted to emphasize that. And Presbyterianism, of all the different views, that was the least tolerated view, frankly. The Westminster Standards actually speak in some ways against premillennialism, and so they started their own denomination, and they actually would modify the Westminster Standards to make it a little bit more premillennial friendly. And then there was a morality issue. Yes?
On premillennialism, was that historic premillennialism or dispensational?
They wanted to not define that as far and say that you could be either in the denomination. Some of the guys called themselves dispensational, but even the ones that called them dispensational weren't that dispensational. More of them were historic premill. Yeah, good question. Some of them wanted to be a morality issue. In other words, about alcohol. Presbyterians have always enjoyed, in moderation, a good beer, you know. The BPC guys, they were of the abstinence camp. So that was an issue. And then another one was a polity issue. Remember this independent board for foreign missions? The BPC guys wanted it to continue and always be an independent board. And the Presbyterians were saying, that was just a temporary thing, right? We know it should be part of the church. The only reason it wasn't part of the church is because of the whole issue with the modernists. And now that we've got our own denomination, of course we want it to be part of the church. And so that became an issue. So the BPC ends up leaving, or those guys, led by Carl McIntyre. He was like the Machen for the BPC guys. They left in June 1937. Some have suggested maybe if Machen was still alive, that maybe he could have helped to keep the peace and work out issues. Who's to say? But I do know I've heard that suggested many, many times. So, you know, stepping back, you know, kind of a couple last questions. What does being a fundamentalist mean? I mean, I think there's a number of ways we can think about that. I think we can think about it within the context of the PCUSA before, when you've got conservatives and moderates, all who would use that label. But the conservatives are willing to say it's something we have to stand and fight for. The moderates somehow can affirm it, but yet think they can work with people who don't affirm it. So does that label really apply then to the moderates? I think that's a fair question. And then in the BPC, I think it also shows that we could all have this label of fundamentalist, but do we all mean the same thing by it? It's interesting. When you hear that term fundamentalist today, what do people tend to think? Pejorative. And what do they tend to think are some of the distinctives?
Anti-intellectual.
What was that?
Someone who is unwilling to consider or listen to the ideas of the
Gentiles. True. You know, one thing I think of is that they're the people who don't drink alcohol and don't do dancing. And I wonder if there's something to be said that some people have thought that route under the banner of fundamentalism. But originally, it was these doctrinal assertions, Mike.
Well, I think even these days now, it's getting pegged as being violence as well.
Yeah.
So.
Because now it's lumped into a broader term, and comparing that with radical Islam, those are fundamentalists there, and we need to oppose those, but embrace the rest of Islam. And in Christians, those fundamentalists there, we need to oppose those, but embrace the rest of Christians. And anywhere there's fundamentalism of any of these religions, then we need to oppose that, because it goes into this pluralistic religion where we're all supposed to be one big unitary universalist group, essentially. And that's not the biblical faith. It's not what we have held. That's not what has been passed down to us. So, you know, I think then point B there, what does being Presbyterian mean, kind of goes in the same thing. I mean, the BPC guys called themselves Presbyterian. And I'm not to say that they're not. You know, one of the things that seemed, I didn't put it on the page here, it seemed that the BPC guys tended to be more just conservative evangelical. They weren't as interested in, like, seeing their Christianity as expressed in the Westminster Standards. In other words, these historic confessional documents actually express what they believe about the Scriptures. And it seems that the OPC guys were much more wanting to be self-consciously understanding this set of doctrinal standards very clearly identifies who we are, and it seems there's a lot less commitment to that among the PPC and just more of an evangelical flavor to it. Conservative evangelical, but...
How active is the BPC
today? Well, you know, it's funny, they're probably about the same size as the OPC, but they don't seem to get nearly as much press. And there have been movements, my understanding, within the BPC putting themselves more toward confessionally reformed, that they're making movements back there, such that I don't remember the exact label, but our denomination has reopened up dialogue with them. What that means, it doesn't mean we're talking about merging tomorrow or affirming everything they believe, but let's begin to have some discussions and iron sharpen iron type thing. Mike?
Two things. One to help answer that, because I'm doing a little bit of research.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because I'm going to talk a little bit about it.
Excellent.
There are a lot of splits, like the RPCS, which later merged, came out of the BPC. And I think at the moment, at least according to Wikipedia, there's like 35 congregations total.
Oh, really? Then I'm off then. I'm way off then.
But second, though, I think it's all, what does it mean? What does Presbyterian mean? In a way, Machen is like the consummate Presbyterian. You're not only in what he believes, but he didn't set out to start a new denomination at the drop of a hat there. I mean, this was 15 years in the running, and it came apparent that they just kicked them out. It wasn't that, well, I'm going to take my ball and go home, but it's like, got to the point, I'm trying to help and reform you guys, and working in the church courts and everything, and essentially functioning in the Presbyterian government, and it just got to the point where it was untenable and unworkable, and at that point, it's clear that there's no other option. So I think in a way, Machen shows, both in not only what he believes, but in how he's operating within the church, what it means to be Presbyterian.
It's a good example, yeah. Jeff?
One of the reasons why so few members went with the new OPC, I believe, is that if they left the mother church, they would lose their property also.
And I didn't put that on the list here. I would have liked to have, just for space-wise. But, one of the problems was if you did this, join this new denomination, you had to turn over your keys to your property. Now, many of them fought that in court, and virtually they all lost. Because the denomination is very clear that we own the property if you leave the denomination. So that's kind of, put your money where your heart is, you know, or your rubber meets the road, you know. Do you really believe this? Because if it is, it's going to require great sacrifice, which will lead us well into today's sermon, I think, too. So we have to look for that today. We're out of time. Mike will carry us on next time. Let me close this in prayer.